I did Chinese in college, and I don't remember anything. Actually, I remember how to say, I'm an American student.
take me to my embassy.
No, please rob me. I'm not going to say it.
Well, we're all decent English speakers.
Yeah, let's do the show in English.
Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. My name is Jody Avergan. President Trump is continuing to face possible legal trouble over campaign finance violations. Meanwhile, the White House is in the middle of another staffing shakeup. Doesn't this feel like the kind of intro you could do almost every week for the last couple of years? Last week, court filings in the Southern District of New York stated that Trump coordinated with and directed Michael Cohen to break campaign finance law. And then on Saturday, Trump announced that his chief of staff, John Kelly, is departing and a replacement has yet to be named. There are lots of rumors floating around. So here to discuss all of that and whether and how they may be related and some other stories of the week are senior politics writer Claire Malone. Hello, Claire.
Hey, Jody.
Managing editor Micah Cohen. Hello, Micah.
Hello.
And joining us on Skype is senior writer Perry Bacon Jr. Hello, Perry.
Good to be with you, Jody.
Nate is out today. Do we have a real-time update on where Nate is? He's tweeting his trip.
I think he's in Japan, isn't
Somewhere
he?
In Japan.
Perry, where are you?
I'm in Louisville, Kentucky today.
Mm. In addition to those two big pieces of Trump news, later in the show, we're going to update you on that possible election fraud story in North Carolina. But let's begin with the Trump-Mueller investigation news. Last week, there was that sentencing document for Trump's former national security advisor, Michael Flynn, his former lawyer, Michael Cohen, and his former campaign chairman, Paul Manafort. Someone want to jump in and just talk about what caught our eye?
Sure. I mean, I guess the official news, and it is important, is that the Southern District of New York, the prosecutor's office, the DOJ office in New York, in its own words, said Trump was part of and encouraged Michael Cohen to pay money to women Trump slept with in order to hide those affairs during the campaign. So in other words, Michael Cohen had already said that in public that Trump was part of this cover-up, but now DOJ itself has said that as well. So that's significant legally. I don't think it was like shocking news to people because we basically sort of already knew Trump was involved in the payoffs to these women, which includes Stormy Daniels, of course. So I think that's sort of the biggest headline from last week. You know, we had that Manafort document that was, but it was heavily redacted. So I didn't leave last week with a whole lot of new knowledge about Trump and Russia that I didn't already have last week. But I think it does tell you this story will keep going and it's getting worse for Trump.
And just to clarify the Russia connection here, this was something that Mueller had kicked to the Southern District of New York, this particular campaign finance thing. And so that was what came out. So it's not a direct – it's connected, but it's not a direct result or sort of iteration of the Mueller investigation.
Right? Yeah, it's separate from the Mueller investigation. I agree with Perry that I didn't think anything was – earth-shattering there. You know, if you believed Michael Cohen, that Trump, quote-unquote, directed this campaign finance violation wasn't new. But, you know, it's worth saying that federal prosecutors wouldn't allege this based only on Cohen.
Right, because you might not believe Michael Cohen,
right,
because he has reasons to tell. So it's he's perhaps not the most credulous person, but if they are putting this in a document from what, you know, everyone is saying, then that means that they have corroborating evidence elsewhere besides Michael Cohen. But he is like the, you know, a person who has said these things and it is corroborated elsewhere.
So then what I sort of came away thinking was, you know, illegal manipulation of the election via campaign finance violations, allegedly. I think you can kind of add as the kind of third avenue of legal jeopardy for Trump, along with collusion with Russia and obstruction of justice, right? Now you have these kind of three different problem areas for him. Now, the question there then is like, how do you rank them in terms of evidence for and how severe are they? How much of a problem could they be?
And you've got, Trump? I mean, you've got top Democrats saying, well, this is, you know, technically the president is party to a crime and it's an impeachable offense. So
yeah.
we'll see you in the winter, folks. Like that's kind of seems to be a little bit the Democrats posturing at this point as it regards this particular
right
case.
But it's also a discrete violation of a sort of concrete law.
Correct.
Opposed to like we've talked about how collusion is a slippery thing. And there's a sort of like the Mueller case is a lot about kind of proving a sort of body of evidence, whereas this is like a very specific law broken in a very specific way that carries very specific consequences.
That people haven't, although this is, I mean, this is when we bring back the ghost of John Edwards and his hair and his affair, which was John Edwards' trial was about campaign finance violations, right? A very similar payment, hush money to a mistress. And as we all know, or I mean, we don't all know, John Edwards wasn't convicted. And there was a, you know, there was a mistrial on several of the counts. So it's a hard, I think the Trump legal team, when they come back, they have, you know, they come back with these lines where it's like, well, he's president. He can't be criminally, you know, he can't be prosecuted while he's president. And that is true that the DOJ has, I guess, guidelines, right? It's not law, but it's guidelines that they wouldn't indict him in office. And then the other part is that it's pretty hard to, or it's, there haven't been that many cases where people have actually been convicted of these particular campaign finance things, which, by the way, separate tangent, people don't really take campaign finance violations very seriously in this country, including how tightly, you know, people run their super PACs and like sort of the ethics surrounding money in politics in America is pretty bad all around.
Well, that's why I was a little surprised. Perry, I'm curious what you think. I was a little surprised that a few Democrats did start mentioning the I word, because in general, you know, impeachment is a political process. And I don't think people take campaign finance laws all that seriously. They're certainly not enforced all that seriously. So while there's like, clearly they prosecutors think they have a good case against Trump on this, you know, I have a hard time imagining successful impeachment proceedings based on this alone, right, Perry?
So, yes, and Jerry Nadler, who's going to be the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, that's where impeachment would start. He was on one of the Sunday shows, and he said these things that Trump that came out last week were impeachable offenses in his view, which surprised me because up to now, Nadler and Pelosi have been sort of trying to like slow the impeachment train down a lot. They've been very much like, we will only move forward if Republicans are for impeachment too, and we know there are no Republicans that are going to be before that. So I was surprised only that Nadler said it, because I agree with Mike. I'm not sure campaign finance violations themselves are necessarily at that threshold. But more importantly, I think unless the Democrats are actually going to move forward on this, I don't think they want to like sort of tease that idea.
So just to clarify, I mean, because Nadler actually, I think, is sort of walking an interesting line here. He said on State of the Union that these violations would be impeachable offenses, but then he went on to say whether they are important enough to justify impeachment is a different question. So I guess maybe he's still trying to thread that needle.
Yeah, but, it's a weird quote.
Well, it's sort of trying
it's
to have
legalistic,
it both ways.
You might say.
Right.
So there's the I word, right? But there's also the J word, and Adam Schiff on Face the Nation said, there is a very real prospect that on the day Donald Trump leaves office, the Justice Department may indict him. He may be the first president in quite some time to face real prospect of jail time. That was pretty surprising to hear from a representative.
Is it?
No one said that before, right?
I was shocked. I have a hard time imagining on day one of the Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders,
Mike Pence,
Beto
depending on when and how Trump leaves office.
I really don't think Mike Pence would do it. But I don't think it's like, you know, the tradition has been that, you know, we don't prosecute our political enemies no matter what they've done, essentially. So I found that quote strikingly because I have a hard time imagining that happening in real life. But Adam Schiff is not a dumb, he's a very smart person. But I just have a hard time seeing the next administration, particularly even if run by a Democrat, actually doing that.
I guess I'm not surprised because I see it as a very political quote, right? In an environment when this stuff has just come out in the news and when people are feeling particularly, I mean, it's in some ways to his advantage to
make it seem more serious.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. But I guess it does kind of get back to, though, that it feels like at this moment, so far, a lot of the Mueller conversation has been about, did Trump behave in a way that would lead the Senate and the House to impeach him because of his sort of comportment during the election and collusion, however you wanted to define that, with Russia. And then there's this other thing, which is just a very clear violation. Of course, as Claire was saying, you know, you can decide whether to prosecute or not accordingly. But it does feel like now there's two fronts. Perry, is your sense that this Southern District investigation, this campaign finance stuff, will it eventually get rolled back into the Mueller investigation? I mean, will all of this kind of end up being one big unified, here's what we found about how Trump behaved himself, or is it going to continue to sort of run on multiple tracks, maybe even fracture even more?
I think it's going to be multiple tracks. I think Mueller has been trying to stay pretty much on things around Russia. Like, even the indictments of Manafort have been around Manafort's relationships with, like, Russian and Ukrainian officials. I do think there is potentially more on the campaign finance, whatever the New York is investigating. I think those are different angles, so I don't think they would merge. I think Mueller's trying to stay on his mandate pretty narrowly. Mueller seems to... We've never heard Mueller's voice this whole time, but he seems to try to be avoiding being the next Ken Starr pretty explicitly. And so I think he would try to avoid, if you get into the Stormy Daniels zone, you're getting into the sort of Monica Lewinsky zone. I think he's going to try to avoid that.
So we'll start to wrap up here a little bit, but let's talk about the Mueller investigation itself. First off, we haven't done this in a while, but is it worth checking in on kind of where it stands in terms of public opinion? I mean, do we feel like the longer it goes on, the more the public becomes skeptical, or is he still, where do we stand?
No, they haven't grown more skeptical. They also haven't, the numbers have been fairly steady. So like 2/3 think Mueller should be allowed to finish his investigation. That's according to a recent Maris poll. 3 in 4 people think the report should be made public, and a majority think it's a fair investigation versus only about 1/3 who think it's a witch hunt. So those are pretty good numbers from Mueller.
That's actually how Marist we asked. We checked.
That's how they asked the question.
It is how they asked the question. Because when we saw these numbers, I was like, really? They asked it that way? And the question is, which of the following statements comes closer to your opinion about Robert Mueller's investigation? It is fair or it is a witch hunt?
I guess
those are the two sides of the coin these days.
That's true.
Okay, use of polling, Marist?
But I guess I'd be curious to see if there's movement after this recent flurry of activity on these fronts. But those are pretty good numbers from Mueller. And I think, as Perry said, he's conscious that whether he likes it or not, he's operating in a political context and will probably act accordingly, which means sort of narrowly staying on mission.
Perry, is your sense that come January, when Democrats take over the House, how high on their priority list is convening a bunch of investigations, using their power to kind of back up Mueller or just continue to prod at Trump in other ways?
Extremely high. Like, Nadler is judiciary. Schiff is on the House Intelligence Committee. He's the chairman of that. Yeah, pretty much every chairman has some particular part of their chairmanship is going to be investigations around Trump. Some will be more like policy oriented. Some will be like more about like how does he, you know, what was the child separation policy? Where did that come from? But I think a lot of them will be sort of Russia related. I think Amelia wrote a few weeks ago, I think it's relevant to think about, is that in some ways, Mueller probably doesn't want these guys interviewing lots of witnesses and getting in the way on some level. So I'll be curious to see Nadler and Schiff are very smart people. So I think they will probably be, you know, I think they are conscious of Mueller and what he's doing. And the Democrats know, I think, that what Mueller finds is more credible than what the Democrats in the House, who of course hate Trump, are going to find. And I'll be curious to see how Trump and his team handle subpoenas. And I can imagine there's going to be a lot of back and forth before there's any real testimony. Like, you know, like the story in the Times just today about, you know, Jared Kushner is text messaging with the Saudi leader a lot. I'm guessing Jared Kushner, that looked really bad for Jared Kushner. I'm not sure he'll go to Capitol to talk about that.
Yeah. You know, what is your sense of what comes next for the Mueller investigation? Was there anything in that heavily redacted document that we got last week that indicates whether this is going to go in a particular new direction, whether it's going to wrap up anytime soon? I mean, what's on the horizon?
It doesn't seem likely to wrap up anytime in the near future.
Safe to say.
Yeah, you know, well, there were people who were like, I think stupidly, you know, speculating that maybe it was coming to an end. You know, even the fact that so much of that Manafort documentation was redacted is meaningful and suggests that, you know, Mueller is sort of still developing lines of inquiry and following lines of inquiry.
Just as we were sort of sitting down to record this, Maria Butina changed her plea. So this was the Russian woman kind of accused of being, I guess, a not very good intel officer. But but some people are reading that as, oh, what's going on there? Maria Butina is the woman who is accused of spying on behalf of, I guess her contact was a Russian official named Alexander Torshin. And she was the person who, she's been portrayed in the media as like the redheaded siren who, you know, worked with the NRA and infiltrated sort of Republican power structures. But yeah, you know, it's funny. I think of the Mueller investigation as almost like a potted plant that sits in the background of the windowsill in Washington and occasionally flowers, sometimes fragrantly, but sometimes not.
What is that really bad smelling plant?
I'm thinking of it as like a gardenia or something.
There are
maybe a Christmas cactus, depending on your taste in plants.
There are reports that
not the rotting corpse plant. That's the one I'm thinking of.
Now that they've wrapped up with Cohen, they're looking at Trump's family businesses more. You know,
yeah.
The Trump Organization, which they'll probably find something there. Right.
I don't know, Micah. I remember that press conference when they laid out all the documents.
Weren't those blank or something?
Yeah, that was pretty much what people was suspected.
Okay. Any other thoughts?
The last thought I had was that if you think of the last year, whatever you think of, whatever Trump has not fired Mueller, but the numbers suggest Trump has done a pretty good job of making the case to Republicans that this investigation is a partisan witch hunt about nothing. I haven't got all the data in front of me, but I think he's done a good job of protecting himself from impeachment if impeachment requires Republicans to sign on board, because Republican voters are not there, so Republican members will not be there either. And I think in some ways he doesn't have to fire anybody as long as he just wants to stay in office.
Well, that sets us up nicely, because Trump may have not fired Mueller, but he has fired or driven out some other folks as well. And we're going to talk about that, because there is some shakeup going on at the White House among the staff there, including the person who will oversee the Russia investigation. We're going to talk about that in a minute. But first, let me tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by GiveWell. Many people want to give to good charities now towards the end of the year, especially. But how can you maximize the good you accomplish for each dollar that you give? GiveWell does in-depth, detailed research to identify evidence-backed, cost-effective programs helping the poorest people in the world. At its website, givewell.org, you can see a very short list of top charities that have met GiveWell's exacting standards. Its current top charities do things like fund programs to prevent child deaths from malaria and provide direct cash transfers to very poor households in East Africa. GiveWell deeply vets scientific evidence for programs. Its charity reviews are accompanied by hundreds of footnotes. We know how much 538 folks love footnotes. It publishes its quantitative cost-effectiveness models. You love models. So you can dive into all the details if you are interested. But if you only want to spend a few minutes, you can just go to GiveWell's top charities and leverage the thousands of hours its staff has put into finding exceptional charities. Make the most of your giving. It takes 2 minutes right now, and go to givewell.org. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Lightstream. This holiday season, give yourself the gift of extra money in your pocket when you consolidate your credit cards with Lightstream. Lightstream offers credit card consolidation loans from 6.14% APR with auto pay. Compare that 6.14% to the national average credit card interest rate of over 19%. You can get a loan from $5,000 to $100,000, and you can even get your money as soon as the day you apply. The application is 100% online, and there are no fees to apply. This holiday season, save even more with an additional interest rate discount, and the only way to do that is by using this URL, lightstream.com/538. That's lightstream.com/538. Subject to credit approval. Rate includes 0.5% auto pay discount. Terms and conditions apply, and offers are subject to change without notice. Once again, visit lightstream.com/538 for more information. All right, we're back now. Last week, Trump announced his nominations for Attorney General and UN Ambassador, and perhaps the biggest news, said that his Chief of Staff, John Kelly, will leave by the end of the year. He hasn't announced a replacement for Kelly yet. So, Perry, just give us a big picture here. Is there a theme to the kind of people who are leaving or being driven out of the administration, and then who is joining the administration in this latest round of shakeups?
Yeah, the one theme I would say is that when the administration first started, Trump was hiring people who kind of had their own. It wasn't clear what I don't know if Trump had an ideology on every issue. It wasn't clear. And he was hiring from different parts of the Republican Party, different kinds of people. Like Nikki Haley had criticized him a lot in 2016, but he hired her for a big job. Henry McMaster was a national security advisor, even though Trump and he didn't agree on policy in any way, as far as I could tell. Rex Tillerson, no one knew what he was really for. And now the new people that are increasingly being brought in are people who I think Trump can count on to some extent, who are going to be, in his view, loyal to him. Like Jeff Sessions allowed this, recused himself from Russia, allowed this Mueller investigation to start. You know, if you look at William Barr's statements, he's been criticizing Mueller pretty bluntly in the investigation for 2 years. So I do think the one thread line I see here is, General Kelly and Trump had a lot of tension. The names I'm seeing floated are people who are going to be more sort of Trumpian and sort of more loyal to Trump. That's what I see is we went from being sort of a team of rivals to a team of loyalists in a certain way.
Can you expand a little bit on that? Because I mean, what about Kelly was not loyal? He seemed to push Trump's agenda. He seemed to back him up. He didn't really kind of go to the media and tell people what he really thought.
There were a year of stories of Trump, of people saying Kelly is trying to stop Trump from X and Y. And, you know, Kelly is imposing discipline, which implies Trump doesn't have any. There's a lot of Kelly has been resistant to some of the things on the border. Trump wanted the border, of course, to be more aggressive. I'm not saying Kelly's not aggressive about border enforcement. I'm just saying that Trump wanted more of it. There's been a lot of stories of, you know, the last year and a half that basically suggesting that Kelly thinks Trump is erratic and undisciplined. And those stories, I assume, came from Kelly, and Trump does not like such stories. And I assume the next chief of staff will leak less often that he thinks Trump is kind of an idiot.
Yeah, I mean, I also think Kelly was a true believer on immigration. I mean, that is why he joined the Trump White House. That is why he became involved. But I do think, I mean, I got to say, I loved Rex Tillerson's coming out of the woodwork. What was it, Friday, Thursday, to basically say what had sort of been reported. You know, when he called Trump a moron, that was what was reported. He essentially said that in a nice way, what he thought about Trump, right? He said he doesn't read, he's unstructured, and I think...
And then he asks people to break the law for him.
Yeah. And listen, I think however people want to judge Kelly and Tillerson and whatever they want to say about their 10 years in the Trump administration, these two guys are disciplined people who worked their way through highly regimented organizations, whether it be the Marine Corps or ExxonMobil, and they obviously do not mesh well with Donald Trump's way of doing things.
Yeah, I think it's a question of kind of what is your distinguishing characteristic? So like Tillerson's distinguishing characteristic when he came in, I think was, you know, he came from the business world, kind of represented the corporate wing of the Republican Party. Kelly's, as Claire said, was a kind of hardline immigration stance. Some of these people that have been named recently sort of don't have a distinguishing characteristic. And so in that void, I think you're just sort of left with loyalty to Trump, dependence on Trump. I mean, Whitaker, the acting AG, was sort of a vessel of Trump, right? And I think that's what Perry is getting at. It's not like these people don't have their own beliefs or their own, you know, resumes, but they lack a power base outside of Trump to a greater extent than people who populated the administration at the start of Trump's tenure.
Right. And also there's an element, I mean, with Barr, and we should talk about William Barr, who's been nominated to be the new attorney general, where his policy beliefs line up with what Trump perceives, at least, he needs at this particular moment. And so there's like a mix of this person will be loyal and also this person will do X, Y, and Z, which Trump wants.
I mean, we should also talk about it is kind of so different that we discuss sort of the in previous administrations, the chief of staff was someone who kind of eased the way of the president, right? Like they weren't someone where they were like, well, what do they believe on this policy? Well, it didn't matter necessarily because sure, they might influence the president, but ultimately they were facilitating the goals of the White House. And the same with the Department of Justice, right? It was they are facilitating the administration's policy. Whereas in the Trump administration, we're doing this kind of new thing where you have to look for, well, which camp do they belong to and which way are they leaning? In part because the administration doesn't have a particular clear focus on a number of issues. And I think we should stop for a second and say like that in and of itself is interesting.
It's also interesting that I don't know if this is putting it too strongly, but this whole the last few days with the chief of staff position have been nuts. Look, I'm not in the White House, so I can't say for sure, but based on how things unfolded, it very much seems like Trump thought he had Nick Ayers, who's Vice President Mike Pence's chief of staff right now, lined up for this job, and then Nick Ayers was like, I don't want this job. That's pretty remarkable. You know, chief of staff to the president of the United States is typically a pretty plum gig, and it seems like Trump is having some problems filling it right now.
I wonder why.
Well, right, yeah.
Perry, why? Why are people turning down this job?
First of all, Nick Ayers sort of played Trump the way Trump played Mitt Romney. Like, so I think Nick Ayers is a savvy guy and probably realized this job is not going to be perfect for him. But I do think on some level, I think that the changes increasingly are where people who are more aligned with Trump are getting jobs. I think that actually is, at the start, I don't think there was an ideology of this administration. I think increasingly there is. And on some level, like, Nick Ayers is kind of establishment Republican guy. He worked for Tim Pawlenty at some point. He's not really, like, Trumpian in a certain way. So I think it might have been better for both sides. This didn't work out. Like, I've seen the name, like, Mark Meadows, the head of the Freedom Caucus, has been floated. That would actually – I don't know what Mark Meadows' organizational, you know, work is, but that would actually make a little bit more sense. Increasingly, I think it actually would make sense for Trump to have people that agree with him in key jobs as opposed to people who kind of don't think – respect his views, kind of trying to work around him all the time. It would make – you know, I just think that's been the common theme is like – I don't know what Stephen Miller's organizational style is, but Stephen Miller believes in the sort of, you know, Trump campaign platform. He believes in the electability of that platform. He would be a person who would be logical, as I think Trump is like trying to pick people who the establishment would like, weirdly, like Nick Ayers. But I don't know if those people would actually be good for Trump. And I think those people themselves are smart enough to not want to be his chief of staff.
I don't know, Perry, because Kelly agreed with Trump on at least some of the big policy questions.
Foreign policy, probably, but yeah.
No, but what you're saying, I mean, you use that word ideology. I'm curious how you would define it. But isn't it just agreeing with Trump is the ideology? It's not about an issue. I will back this person up no matter what.
Tillerson is like a – maybe Tillerson is a long time ago, but Tillerson supported like the Iran deal and the Paris deal. Those things were not – and he was trying to push Trump toward those things. Those people need to be weeded out because they don't agree with Trump on anything. That's maybe exaggerating. So Kelly is a little harder, but I think Kelly does not support the weird Russia policy Trump wants. Nobody else does either. But,
what's interesting about the mention of Mark Meadows is that – I mean, you know, you've got Mick Mulvaney – another former member of the Freedom Caucus moving in. I mean, it's interesting to me that this particular group that was the thumb in the eye 4 years ago could now be taking over, like, literally the
now they're the eye.
Yeah, now they're the eye. It's just it's a fascinating transition that happened incredibly quickly.
I guess what I'd say, though, is I think there have been a couple conflicts in the White House around policy. Like Perry, as you said, you know, Tillerson disagree with Trump on climate, but the conflict between Trump and his chiefs of staff have been more about like process and temperament and norms. And so honestly, I would not be totally surprised if Trump doesn't appoint a chief of staff.
I was just thinking that.
Or appoints three chiefs of staff and they're more like office managers, you know, like I just think there's a structural problem here.
No, I'm just thinking about Dwight Schrute, assistant to the managing man.
I could be chief of staff.
I think Mike is right, is that there is a component of this that is purely like Trump doesn't want to be. I think Rahm Emanuel has an op-ed, interestingly, in The Atlantic today, basically saying if you want a chief of staff who actually works, you have to empower that person. And there's very little evidence Trump wants to empower anyone.
Let's wrap up a little bit with William Barr. He's nominated to be the new attorney general. He will oversee the Russia investigation among many other things. So Perry, what do we need to know about him and his prospects going forward?
So William Barr's public policy views on most issues like immigration, like law and order, he's like Jeff Sessions. Like, he's sort of an old style Republican. He's not for criminal justice reform. He's for get tough on the border. On most issues, I think he'll be pretty similar to Jeff Sessions, except on the Russia issue, where I think he will be more Trump-like, or I think that's what Trump thinks. In terms of his prospects, we now have 53 Republican senators instead of 51. Also, the flakes and the corkers are gone now. And the 53, I would argue, are more conservative than the 51 before. So I think he has pretty good prospects. Also, even though whatever you think of Barr's record, he was the attorney general before. He's eminently qualified by resume. And it's hard for me to see him not being confirmed.
Yep.
Yep.
Okay. Good.
Yeah.
Good way to end that segment. All right. So we're going to move on and we're going to check in on the possible election fraud in North Carolina's 9th congressional district. Before we do that, though, let me tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by Mott and Bow. Mott and Bow jeans are beautifully handcrafted. The family artisans who make the jeans have been honing their denim skills for decades. And now you can be the recipient. You can tell the second you put on your first pair. Who doesn't want jeans made by artisans? Everything in your life should be made by artisans, including your jeans. What's more, they are at least half the price of designer jeans of the same quality that would sell for $200 or more. With Mott & Bow jeans, you'll get ridiculously comfortable jeans that are good looking with a classic jean style and all for a fair price. And the real difference here is the convenient try-on program. This is the perfect gift for those of you who are indecisive or perhaps those of you who fall between sizes. You can order two pairs of jeans and they'll come with a prepaid, pre-printed shipping label. Once you find the perfect pair, you keep that one and you just send back the pair that you don't want. It's all super easy. And right now you can get 20% off your first purchase by going to mottandbow.com and enter politics at checkout. That's mottandbow.com and enter the promo code politics. All right, for our final segment today, let's check back in on North Carolina's 9th District. Last week, we talked in depth about the possible election fraud there, in which voters described someone collecting mail-in ballots from their homes. That is illegal, of course, and the implication is that the person either filled out unsealed ballots or destroyed them in order to help Republican Mark Harris, who won by less than 1,000 votes. There have been some updates since last week, so Micah, you want to jump in and kind of tell us where this story stands right now?
I think relative to when we checked in last week, the malicious nature of whatever happened here has become sort of more certain, if that makes sense, where the prospect that this is some innocent mistake or some weird confluence of factors that we just don't have a handle on yet seems very, very remote. And I think you've seen a couple kind of discrete things that lead to that. One, the Harris campaign, the Republican campaign, released a FEC filing that showed they paid $34,000 or at least $34,000 to a firm that employed this consultant that allegedly or potentially was messing around with these absentee ballots. So there's one sort of layer between whatever was happening on the ground in the Harris campaign, but it seems like only one layer, which is not a ton of layers. I just mean that, like, it's not like,
You know what I mean? No. It wasn't a sophisticated conspiracy if there was one.
Exactly. Yeah. They contracted with somebody who contracted with somebody. It was, you know. And then Harris, I think, has in his messaging, has moved a little bit as a result, where Republicans in North Carolina before had sort of been like, certify this result. This is crazy. Let's get this over with. Certify the result. And now they're a little bit more like, well, if you can show me evidence that there was fraud here large enough to change the result, I'm open to a new election. Large enough to change the result is a key phrase there.
Right.
And, you know, the law doesn't necessitate that. But,
right.
But the politics might. That's an interesting discussion. According to the law, I think, they can decline to certify the results and call for a new election if the language is like, if there is fraud that would, you know, cast a pall over the election.
The House could also refuse to seat him.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sorry. So, yeah, there's kind of two ends to this. There's the results could not be certified locally, in which case I think the politics are pretty simple. If they're not, in order for that to happen, you'd have to have sort of a clear case, and I think the politics would play out and there'd be a new election. The kind of middle ground that I think could be potentially messy is if North Carolina does certify the results, but then the House Democrats don't seat Harris.
Yeah.
Then you would, I think, have a big fight, and I don't know how that would play out.
I mean, is there any chance, Perry, that the House Democrats seat Harris at this point?
Hard for me to see that right now, because Pelosi was pretty strong in saying we're going to keep looking at this carefully and not likely to do that. And I think there'll be a lot of pressure because of the nature of what happened, not to seat Harris.
Ooh.
You disagree, Micah?
A little bit. I think if the story plays out such that the Harris campaign did not know about this and no evidence comes out that they did, and if things develop where maybe, you know, the scale of this is on the smaller end of what's possible now, and the results get certified, then I think it would be hard for Pelosi not to seat Harris. If locally, let me put it this way. I think it would be hard for Pelosi to be seen as acting against, like, North Carolina.
Huh. Interesting.
We agree. If it's certified in North Carolina and it's not connected to Harris, I agree with you. I wasn't sure how likely that was.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to steal for a second from, I heard this on the Slate Gadfest, but someone brought up a really good point, which is this sort of like election fraud where it's not, you know, I feel like we talk so often about the not very prevalent problem of
voter
fraud. Yeah. But this kind of fraud is so common in American history that we have blanket jokes about the city of Chicago and its election fraud, or like, you know,
JFK
or LBJ, or, you know, it's sort of interesting, or like, you know, anything with Huey Long, right? Which I'm not saying is good, obviously, but it is this kind of, I think we've become used to talking about fraud in this sort of, oh, it's an insidious threat, right? You don't see it, but it's happening. And this looks pretty much like good old fashioned fraud.
Ballot stuffing. It's really like, yeah.
But so we got into this a little bit last week, but I don't think we really kind of talked about whether this is certainly a bonkers case. I mean, some of these details are sort of stunning. But is it also just that you could kind of scratch below the surface of a lot of elections in this country and find this kind of behavior, and we just are maybe more willing to scratch these days, or there's something about the media environment, or is this really so out there that it's going to break through?
I don't think we have evidence to say that this is something that happens in a lot of places. It might, but I'm not willing to like say that.
Right, or maybe not even this specifically, but just that, as you were saying, you know, our democracy is so messy that in a lot of elections, and maybe the margin isn't that close, so it doesn't really matter, but you can look, if you really pry, you would see some unsavory behavior.
I think it'd be really easy to find messiness. I think this level of what at least appears to be very intentional and deliberate and planned fraud, I'm sure exists elsewhere, but it can't be incredibly common.
There are certainly, I mean, because this has to do with picking up absentee ballots, things like that, you can certainly find activists, particularly in the South, who will say this particular precinct, which is black, there was some weird stuff going on. People were, you know, you can make the provisional ballots argument where people are sort of turned away for bad reasons, right? And those cases are sort of, they drip out after elections. They're litigated in the after effect, and, you know, local magistrates run those cases and they don't have the same impact, or they don't have the same media play, but they might have similar impacts where they have disenfranchised people. So I think this is obviously, it's a lurid example of fraud.
Perry, I mean, we can end on this note, but, you know, does it feel like we're living in a time where there's more willingness to question some of the way our democracy works, more maybe appetite for that, or is it just like a couple of these things will pop up every once in a while and we move on?
I don't know the answer to that question. I mean, I think there is more discussion of gerrymandering and voting irregularities and sort of are people being allowed to vote in a fair way. It happened in Georgia, particularly this cycle. I think my final thought is, though, this couldn't happen in a worse place. There's a logical need here for a new election, but North Carolina is one of the most politically divided, zero-sum states. I'd argue the Republican Party of North Carolina is really more radical than most. Like, the things that happened in Wisconsin last week were invented in North Carolina. So the odds that the North Carolina Republicans and Democrats come together and decide we should have a new election, even though that's clearly the remedy probably here, I think are really low. That's my concern, is I don't know how you resolve. Maybe this can't be resolved anyway, anywhere in any state, but maybe Rhode Island will be better than North Carolina.
So actually, let's pick up on that. I mean, Perry said that a new election might be the most reasonable next step, or a way to kind of start fresh here. Is that a possibility? What would that look like?
So yes, it's definitely a possibility. It could take a couple different forms at this point. If the State Board of Elections doesn't certify Harris, then they would sort of just redo the November election. No primaries, just to kind of like, let's try this again. I think Harris would have to be the candidate unless he, God forbid, died, or less God forbid, moved out of state. I don't really care where.
So Harris would be the candidate, though, Ken.
Harris would be the candidate.
A little awkward.
Right. If Pelosi in the House declines to seat Harris, so let's say the Board of Elections certifies the result, but Pelosi's like, nah, we're not seating you, then I think they would have both the primary and the general election again, And potentially that would give Republicans a few more options. Because you have to imagine if they have to hold this election again and Harris is the Republican candidate, I'm sure he wouldn't do that well.
That's a situation where I think it would be interesting to see if the local Republican Party would try to start a write-in campaign.
Yeah, write-in or like I don't know.
I don't know if there'd be the political will for it.
Yeah,
but
if they could do that.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll see what comes next on that front. And so this was a good update, but I have a much more important update, which is, you remember last week we had Michael Bitzer on to talk about this.
Yes.
And he has continued to be fantastic on this and writing about this and tweeting about this. And we mentioned on the show that his Twitter handle is @bowtiepolitics. And then we pointed out that he should go by the URL bowtiepolitics.com. Well, we said that on the show. One of our listeners, one of our enterprising listeners, heard that, immediately went and checked to see if bowtiepolitics.com was available, and it still was. So he snatched it up before someone else could. I guess Dr. Bitzer had just gotten busy for the rest of the day and couldn't go buy it. And then through me, I put them in touch, and now he has transferred bowtiepolitics.com to Dr. Bitzer, who is the rightful owner of it. So shout out to Jonathan Kohlmeyer, one of our listeners, for doing that.
You know,
very nice.
I bought a website for the first time in my life.
Bowtiepolitics.org?
No, I bought whoisindividual1.com.
Is that one with a number or one spelled out?
I think with a number. I'm not sure.
So now you got to buy it spelled out.
But I bought
That's key.
It.
You have to buy it. I have to buy both.
I bought it and then quickly realized I don't know how to do anything with it.
Do you know
Squarespace, sponsor us.
If anybody wants to buy Individual One.
You know that I own importantjournalism.com. And unimportantjournalism.com.
Oh, that's a good investment.
Yeah.
What's on
drunk, drunken purchase? No, none of that. But they both redirect to BuzzFeed.
Oh, that's funny.
No, they don't. But okay, that's the end of the show. Thank you to Claire. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Micah.
MicahCohen.com is not owned.
Oh, go for it. And thank you, Perry Bacon Jr.
Thanks, guys.
My name is Jody Avergan. Galen Druk is our producer, and Tony Chow is in the control room. You can get in touch by emailing us podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments about the show. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.